drives us, in my case, why I ended up running the Australian National Survey, I have no idea. But it was something that was seeded here. And I just want to publicly acknowledge Yale for that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, very quickly, about sustaining. As the head of a government agency and someone who advises ministers and on one occasion the Prime Minister, I have to be a little bit careful about what I say as a public servant, particularly in another country. Fortunately, last year I was the president of the Society of Economic Geologists, and so I'm giving this as the past president of the Society of Economic Geologists, and this is not any way, size, shape or form, a statement from the Australian Commonwealth. So, and somewhere the Macintosh translates the SEG logo. I'm going to talk a little bit about resources. Every once in a while, people panic. They tend to panic when metal prices go up, and they tend to panic when consumption rises, as happened recently with the massive growth and development in China. And so, of course, the inevitable happens that people begin to worry about, we're going to run out of minerals. And this was a New Scientist cover from 2007, the shocking state of the Earth's mineral resources. And the authors of the cover article conclude, even resources of such commonplace elements as zinc, copper, nickel, phosphorus used in fertilisers will run out in the not-too-distant future. Basically, the message of this paper was, we're going to run out of all of this stuff, we're all going to be ruined, we're all going to die. And this is blatant nonsense. It's based on the fact that non-geologists, non-economists take mineral reserve figures. They say, well, say there's 100 tonnes of copper reserves known in the world, we're mining at the rate of 10 tonnes a year, therefore we're going to run out in 10 years. There's no understanding of the process by which mineral reserves are developed and the way the mineral industry accounts for the reserves and when they turn and publish a reserve, the process that goes on behind the scenes. And so that's part of the problem. At a much higher and more sophisticated level, and I'm really delighted that Bob Gordon's here today. I never took a course from Bob, but I have to say I've been an avid reader of all his work in sort of industrial sustainability, the flows of resources. But he published with some other colleagues from here at Yale in 2006 a wonderful paper on the issue of sustaining minerals, can we, can't we, and plotted a plot that I use regularly advising governments, which is a plot over basically three centuries of the discovery of copper reserves or resources, I won't get into the legal side of that, versus extraction rates. And you can see these two curves coming together. And if you're in the game I'm in, that's a pretty worrying couple of trends because if you start to extrapolate into the future, these things will cross. And we will be using things up faster than we're finding them. And I think that's really the theme that I just want to push today. Now, if I was an economist, if I was a Yale-trained economist but interested in minerals, and if my name was John Tilton, I'd probably stand up here and have a bit of an argument with Bob about some of the deep significance of these plots and whether it's as alarming as it looks like. I'm not interested in that. There's a whole other world of where that can be argued. What I'm interested in is there is no doubt that discovery rates are falling. Let me just talk a bit about the interplay of economics and geology to make an ore reserve. Brian Skinner used to ram this down the throat of his various ore deposit classes, the famous McKelvey Vox, which just tries to plot geological certainty on the horizontal axis and economic certainty on the vertical box. And up in one corner where you're certain you've got the stuff in the ground and you're certain you can actually extract it at a profit, it's a reserve. I'm not going to talk about how economics, you can vary the economic side of that plot, but I will just talk a little bit about improving geology certainty. A lot of the reserve testing comes from drill testing of a known deposit, and this is where some of the scaremongers get puzzled. They don't understand. They think if a company publishes a reserve, that's the final figure, but in fact they're continually drilling, testing, upgrading reserves and the like. To expand reserves, by far the most common way of doing that is what I call brownfields exploration. That's drilling adjacent to a known mineral body, and a large chunk of the reserves that increases that we see around the world annually are in fact simply companies, as they're developing their mines, they go further out, they develop. They drill test, and so they find more mineralisation, and you see the answer, we get more reserve. Similarly, they go out from a known deposit and they drill in the paddock, I don't know what the paddock field in this country. They drill nearby a couple of kilometres within sight of the mill, and they make discovery of satellite deposits. Sometimes those satellite deposits are bigger than the original deposit. Again, it's a brownfield process. All of those processes systematically, annually around the world, keep the reserve base going up. And if I was John Tilton, I'd say to Bob, well, those two curves will never cross because they're just creeping up together. But the real big thing is, no matter how you look at it, if countries like China, if countries like India do adopt cultural habits as we have in the Western world, we're going to need new greenfields discoveries. Those are deposits discovered well away from known mineral provinces. And that's really where I think there's been a huge failure in minerals exploration over the last couple of decades. To explore in these other areas, we need geological concepts. We need to think about, from what we know about existing deposits, to go out and find new ones in new areas. But we also need new technologies, and there's nothing very fundamental about that. At a conference of the Society of Economic Geologists in Keystone, Colorado in 2006, a very eminent Yale graduate from G&G, a guy called Chip Goodyear, who at the time was the head of BHP Billiton, the world's biggest resource company, Chip showed this diagram. The red line is exploration expenditure, both greenfields and brownfields in the Western world for a period 1950 to 2004. And the bar chart shows the number of big ore deposits discovered. You can see that the real peak of mineral exploration success is around 1969-1970. You can see during boom and bust cycles, which are characteristic of the minerals industry, we've had ups and downs in exploration expenditure. And you can see down there towards the present that the red expenditure line's going up, and there's very little to show for that effort. The guy who actually developed that slide for Chip, neither of them now work for BHP, I might say, but he provided me with an update of his diagram taking us out to 2007, where you see the mineral boom just continued to roll on. Global exploration expenditure of base metals reaches an all-time high. It's since collapsed due to the big meltdown in Wall Street last year, but we still don't have any discoveries to show for it. So for the first time ever in sort of post-World War II history, we're pumping humongous quantities of money into exploration and we're not finding anything. Chip very concisely articulated the problem. The declining discovery rate for world-class base metal deposits is attributed to the diminishing number of deposits around the world that are amenable to discovery by relatively easy prospecting from the surface. Most important discoveries in the future will come at depth. And what I'm advocating here is we need to think very carefully about how we move from a period of relatively easy surface prospecting and exploration to a new paradigm of finding ore bodies deep undercover. As an Australian, that's an exciting challenge because most of Australia's prospective rocks are buried deep undercover, at least the ones that haven't been explored to date. And fortunately, we have a remarkable discovery made just before I left Yale at a place called Olympic Dam in South Australia. Where I grew up, this place was beyond the Black Stump. Where Brian grew up, I'm not sure what they called it. It was home, I think, Brian. But, but out under the Australian desert, way north of the civilised part of South Australia, and it's not a very big part, the civilised part, but way out in the deserts of northern South Australia, the then Western Mining Company, following a very rigorous scientific exploration program, drilled a hole and at 300 metres went into some low-grade copper mineralisation. The company persisted in their drilling, and it was hole number 9 revealed a huge intersection of copper with a little bit of gold. And then many, many months later, someone made a mistake of running a scintillometer along the core and realised it was actually loaded with uranium. Today, Olympic Dam is the world's biggest uranium deposit. It is the world's fourth biggest copper deposit, and it's the world's fifth biggest gold deposit. That's all in the one deposit. And it's had a huge impact on the Australian economy. It's had a huge impact on the global energy thinking with the amount of uranium that was found in that deposit. More importantly, it's of a type of mineralisation no one knew about. When I went to Yale, when I was taught economic geology by Brian, and most people, I think, here would argue he was still is world's leading economic geologist, he didn't tell me about Olympic Dam type deposits. He didn't tell me about IOCG deposits. He told me about all the deposits we knew about. We didn't know about this type. So I just challenge you to think, what else is out there under 300 metres of sand? What styles of mineralisation don't we know about? Just because in earth processes, certain ore types may never, ever make it to the surface. In Chip's time at Olympic Dam, they had probably the world's biggest ever greenfields exploration program. They decided, let's see how big this thing is. And the plot there shows a number of millions of tonnes of contained copper from 2001. And I should say at that 30 figure there where they started, that was way, way above the original Western Mining estimates. The company had a huge drilling program, 18 big rigs drilling at 400 metre centres across the desert, and they more than doubled the size of the deposit in the space of, as you see there, a drilling program over about 3 years. They still don't know how big it is. It's still open in most directions other than upwards. Some big lessons have been learnt from the discovery of Olympic Dam. I'm proud to say it. One of the key elements in the discovery was the use of the Bureau of Mineral Resources regional geophysical data. That's my agency now, rebadged as Geoscience Australia. They used existing airborne magnetic imagery, contour maps and gravity data, and there's a little circle there, I won't go through the science, that's not for today. But they were looking for an area where they had a little gravity and a little mag coincident anomaly, and they drilled it. Look what happened. Now, you can argue, that was just random chance. It was not random chance. There's a lot of other science went into the selection of that particular place to drill. I think the proof was in the pudding. They found not what they were looking for, they found something much better, but a lot of elements of their search model were bang on. So Olympic Dam has shown us the way that geophysics is the way of the future. I'm sorry to say that as a geologist, steeped in the history of minerals and rocks and rock types and mineralogy, but I'm sorry, if you're into mineral exploration, the future is going to be in rock properties and geophysics. Till you find something, then you're allowed to get back into the old paradigm. New concepts. bring new discoveries. Of course, the minute people realised we're dealing with an ore type, there was a rush then to see where else can we apply this model. Just in South Australia, Lybick Dam found in 1975 under 350 metres of cover. 2001, the Prominent Hill deposit, which is a 200 million tonner, a little one by OD standards, but by world standards, still a very big copper deposit, with lots of gold found under 100 metres of cover. And in 2005, under 490 metres of cover, using some very sophisticated geophysics, a syndicate with South Australian government backing found the Carrapateena deposit, now being looked at by Tech Cominco. There's some ownership issues that are being resolved, so the true size of Carrapateena is not known, but I do mention that their hole number 50 intersected 905 metres, grading 2.1% copper, 1 gram per tonne gold, starting at a depth of 487 metres. That is a phenomenal intersection, and I'm sure in time that will be a big mine. Danny's getting anxious now, so you can rest assured, Danny, we're nearly there. So, very quickly, as I say, I'm just skimming across the top here. Deep greenfields exploration. This is the sort of stuff that kids should be thinking about now when they come to university and they go to graduate school. If they're interested in minerals, if they're interested in sustaining metal supplies for the lifestyle we enjoy, a growing focus will be on 3D geological mapping that makes extensive use of geophysical data and geophysical techniques to constrain subsurface geology. That will necessitate a move away from thinking about minerals and their host rocks in rock types, mineral terms, to thinking about it in rock property terms. And also, we need to see a move away from descriptive ore deposits models, the so-called genetic models that tell us what it is and how it formed, to much more rigorous search hypotheses that can be tested and disproved, but have a rigour in predicting location. Now, one last thing there. And finally, what OD has taught us, if you get in early and you manage to jag a mineralisation, you get the opportunity to look at entire mineral systems, not just a vein here or a vein there, in the way that we tended to operate at the surface, where someone made a discovery, slapped a lease around it and mined it and didn't appreciate it was part of a much bigger system. And I see a big move in mineral systems that are going to be crustal in scale, maybe down into the mantle, who knows, but some of the geophysics talks we heard yesterday certainly excited me in terms of where these big systems might come from and where they're going. And finally, whenever I give an address to people interested in mineral resources, I challenge them to say, this is your future. This is Brian Skinner's home country. And I challenge them to think, will your research help locate a major ore deposit beneath 300 metres of barren cover rocks? And a killer subtitle or sub-question that is, if so, how? And you would be amazed how few economic geologists around the world can cope with those two questions. Thank you.